Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Shortcode Podcast.
Welcome back to the Shortcode Podcast. The fact that it is casual Friday as we record this show offers only a small contribution to the joy I feel. Yes, the dad jeans I wear are a symbolic expression of my liberation from my oppression by the man. And while the man can rescind that permission to wear these symbolic leg coverings at any time, because of special events that require the wearing of the slacks of professionalism, that hasn't happened this week. And so I'm pretty joyous. But it's not the real reason I feel so much joy. The remainder of it is due to the presence of Greg Woods and special guests, CCOM medical students Melissa Palma and Hana Kadir. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi there.
So, Hana, Melissa, I was pleased that you're interested in coming because I want to hear about your interesting away rotation that you did in Texas.
Yes. So Hana and I are both fourth-year medical students here at the University of Iowa. And one of the away rotations that we lovely fourth-year students had the privilege of attending was called Community for Children. And it was a community pediatrics rotation on the Texas-Mexico border, affiliated with the University of Texas San Antonio Health Sciences Center. And so we spent a month down there learning about border communities, learning about the Rio Grande Valley and how health and social determinants of health are greatly impacted by issues of immigration, poverty, healthcare access, and a lot of other things that we feel very passionate about and we had the privilege of experiencing in South Texas.
So maybe we can start with the people that live here. I mean, can you tell us about the folks that live here and what their lives are like?
Well, sure. So the whole entire border region is pretty unique in that really, even though it's called the border region, borders kind of have a unique role in that there's not really a border distinction between the individuals who are living in the U.S. territorial side of Texas and the Mexican side of the border. Families live on both sides and people work on both sides. So there's U.S. citizens who either live on the Mexican side, work on the U.S. side, or vice versa. And there are Mexican citizens who live on either the Mexican or the U.S. side and work there as well.
I think that's really interesting because I don't think a lot of people realize how, mm-hmm. I mean, I think a lot of people think of the border as this line that one shall not cross because there's a fence that, you know, various administrations have wanted to put up and all that kind of stuff. But that's not the case, at least in this.
At least in the Rio Grande Valley, definitely not the case. There is a fence. We've seen the fence. We've touched the fence. It's more of a symbolic fence. The real border is perhaps a few, it's really along the main highways leading up into further north in Texas. So if you were to try and go further north, definitely there's more of a checkpoint system that makes sure that individuals can't cross without having citizenship status or residency status or whatever that may be.
And this is some distance north of the actual border.
It's about an hour and a half driving on a main highway.
Okay.
In between, so the lower Rio Grande Valley, the major metropolitan areas there include McAllen, Harlingen, Brownsville on the U.S. side. And then on the Mexico side, they include the towns of Reynosa and Matamoros. And so like we said before, those communities, I kind of like to make an analogy between Iowa City, Coralville, Cedar Rapids. It's all within this one corridor of economic region that mm-hmm. back and forth functions as a single unit. But in this special case in the lower Rio Grande Valley in South Texas, it's separated by a political border, even though the cultural borders or the economic borders are much more fluid. The people who live in South Texas and the Rio Grande Valley, approximately 95% of the population there is Hispanic, majority of Mexican origin. So most people down there speak Spanish. People who live in the U.S. speak English, are bilingual. It's a very interesting place because you would think, because they have so much rich cultural heritage and this ability to be bilingual, when you think about, you know, all of the, like, the yuppie parents, they want to put their kids in immersion schools. That's what they have down here, but not necessarily in a way that economically benefits the people who live there.
Yeah, and I mean, there are definitely differences in terms of, say, you do work on the U.S. side. Obviously, the laws that are in existence in the States would protect you much more if you do live on that side in terms of the rights that individuals have, versus on the Mexican side, which is taken into account with some of the trade deals that occur between the U.S. and Mexico, with, you know, much of the more dangerous aspects of production occurring on the Mexican side due to those. Although, technically, Mexico has very strict environmental laws, for example. Practically speaking, in terms of enforcement, there's not as much power behind it, and so that's a little bit leaner. So there are, not to say that there's this homogeneous, kind of 100% similar across borders, but there are some, you know, distinct differences, but in terms of what people feel every day, not as much as you would assume, or even kind of can tell if you're living in the area. So, like, there is a border and there's checkpoints, but imagine trying to control the movement of individuals between Coralville and Iowa City. Like, that would be impractical given how much people are going back and forth to have every person screened. So it's just more like a screening question that occurs if you work across the border. They kind of, you know, no one's putting that much effort into it. It's not efficient to do it at that point. It's much more practical to do it further up north.
Anytime you land in the Brownsville airport, there's a government official who stands there very intimidating and looks at you and says, "Are you a U.S. citizen?" And if you say yes, you get on the plane.
Except for me, who's African-American and got some follow-up questions.
Yeah. So it's very interesting because the checkpoints at the border, we were saying that they're a formality, they're fluid, but the real, you know, strip search, we're going to clear your car, we're going to take people out, happens about an hour and a half north, and that's where they really put the enforcement.
Okay.
And so we want, you know, as medical students, we wanted to see what would happen if we put the white kids in one car, and we put the African American, Asian, brown kids in another car,
okay.
And how would we be treated differently? We're all medical students. We're all here
for legitimate
purposes, and just by how we look, what would be the different treatment? And we didn't end up doing that, but we always thought that we would.
Disappointing.
You let us on. So you alluded to this a little bit, Hannah. What kind of industries are there? What do people do for work here?
Sure. I always let Melissa say the word.
So the word is maquiladora, which just basically means
factories. Yeah, and so, I mean, there's been one thing to mention is there are a lot of activists and their community members who are really looking out for this community. There's a great deal of need, and both physicians, lawyers, all sorts of professionals and community individuals who work in this. And so this is an area where there's been a lot of development in terms of trying to get more rights for the individuals who work there. So the maquiladoras on the other side of the border, on the Mexican side, produce almost like pretty much a lot of things that we use on a daily basis, from automobile parts to toys, like part car, like Fisher-Price, I think, General Motors. Most of the major, like almost like Fortune 500 companies have part of their production, not like maybe entirely, but part, something that's part of their product is being produced there. And some of it is chemical, some of it is like manual labor, there's a lot of different there's differences along all of the different ones. But the thing that is kind of unique is that the population who works in the maquiladoras, who are both Mexican and U.S. citizens, do have historically a lot of grievances in terms of rights, in terms of breaks, in terms of pay differences that occur, in terms of exposure to environmental hazards that could have health implications.
And so this was very interesting in the case of...
I don't remember what the name of the actual law case was.
Yeah, so in 1994, NAFTA was the North American Free Trade Agreement, was ratified, saying that essentially that allowed for these production of movement of U.S. unfinished goods movement across the border into these maquiladoras, which are literally right across the border from the U.S. There's over 122 plants in Matamoros alone in one city along the U.S.-Mexico border. And these places don't necessarily have the same oversight, environmental or OSHA regulations as they would in the U.S. So you can make things for cheaper, the labor is cheaper. As far as the multinational corporations are concerned, this is a great deal for them. But what does this mean for the health of the populations of the people who live and work in these communities?
So let me make sure I understand. These factories are making goods out of the raw materials that they get from basically from the U.S. transported. Mm-hmm. Those materials are transported across the border, and then they're turned into the products, which then probably come back to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes. And so, you know, when we were there, we learned about in the mid to late 90s, this essentially outbreak of myelomeningocele.
With anencephaly in particular.
So what this means is, in the early 90s, anencephaly is a birth defect in which the brain, the head of the infant, does not form in utero correctly. And so these babies can be born without a brain or without a head. And in one OB or pediatrician's lifetime, they might see, you know, maybe one case of this. And there was a single weekend where a OB and pediatrician in Brownsville delivered 3 babies with anencephaly. And so this sparked an entire public health campaign and research project to try and figure out what were the causes of this outbreak.
And they weren't necessarily and it also sparked like a legal battle between some lawyers from the community who basically did, 2 of them who devoted their time to try and fight these companies, because there was a link epidemiologically with like things that I don't know about that involve movement of like particles across the air, whatnot, and the cluster of where the cases were found. And so they looked further into maybe this was a link with exposure to some hazardous byproducts during the processing that was occurring in these maquiladoras, and or the workers who were being exposed who worked there coming back to their communities on the U.S. side or their homes and possibly exposing others.
So there were a lot of suspects as to why this could be.
Yes, yes. And no definitive final, as with many legal issues, final sort of decision or 100% link was made, either epidemiologically, I think, or legally. However, in the investigation that occurred, a lot of infractions were found in terms of the safety of the maquiladoras and the exposure that some of the workers were getting, in terms of like the amount of regulated byproducts that were being exposed into the air or disposed of improperly in these big waste, what are they called? Like the big, just like...
they're just dumping grounds.
Yeah, dumping grounds, which was illegal. And so at some point, the lawyers were literally following trucks leaving from the maquiladoras to these dumps. And although the companies were saying this was absolutely not occurring, they had it on video. And so the end thing is that there were changes that were made by the companies in the end as a result of the legal battle, which would hopefully improve the health of the overall community and the lives of the individual workers working there. But not, and some, I think there was also some families got some money as well in some of this, like a few cases were settled out.
But that's just one example. Minority.
Yeah. And that's kind of one example of like, you know, the byproduct of the border situation and how that's manifested into effects on an actual individual's lives.
So how does one mount any sort of a public health campaign when you have the border to deal with, but this is such a multifaceted, situation?
Yeah, so I feel like one thing that we really learned from this experience and took away from this experience is the power of grassroots community organizations. So the group that we worked with through Community for Children, Dr. Marcia Griffin, who is this amazing pediatrician who works at the Brownsville Community Health Center, she and her husband, Michael Seifert, run the Rio Grande Equal Voice Network, and it is a organization that brings together different aspects of the community who are working on different facets of this problem. So like we said before, there's the Department of Public Health, there's the Texas Legal Aid There's ProBar, which is an association of pro bono lawyers. There's a lot of different players who each tackle some small role within the greater problem or the greater issue.
Like there have to be.
And you would have to. And by the fact that they have this amazing network of people who all care and who all are fighting for the needs of their community is just so inspiring for us to take away and hopefully replicate that a little bit in our own communities.
What about, we've been hearing a lot about the so-called surge of unaccompanied minors entering the U.S., which I think started in
around 2011-12. 12 was the major surge. So minors have been crossing the border into the U.S. for decades, but the number was usually around 6,000 to 8,000 minors a year. And so in the mid to late 90s, there were some laws that were passed in the U.S. to make sure that kids weren't being turned away or deported immediately as they were apprehended at the border, because there were cases of humanitarian crisis that were occurring. Some of these kids were trafficked or were fleeing persecution or fleeing assault or violence to themselves from cartels or gangs that were occurring in the area, and that was recognized. But then the kind of progression of all the crisis in the region, which has occurred most recently in El Salvador and Honduras and Guatemala, has kind of created a greater push to get these kids out of their home countries, which are violent and poor, and where some of their family members are not there anymore, who are already in the U.S. or in other countries, and kind of propelled a greater surge of the kids. So now the projected end of fiscal year 2015 number of kids crossing the border is up to 70,000. So from 8,000 to 70,000, that's a huge difference.
Holy smokes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, already I think close to 60,000 kids in 2014 year crossed.
So what are the effects of this surge locally that you saw?
Yeah, so most of the kids are crossing at the Rio Grande Valley. So there are some who are going through California, Arizona, all of the border states, but a majority of them do cross at the Rio Grande Valley. And there's a system in place regulated by the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which kind of shelters these kids temporarily. So they get processed at a detention center. Some of them get immediately placed with family members who are identified in the states or other foster families. But most of them will be sent to shelters, which are usually run for kids by non-government nonprofit organizations who get funding from ORR. And then they provide the actual care of the kids while their deportation, immigration cases are being filed and looked at. And so for the area that we were in, I spent a month in a shelter, which was in, it was kind of in San Benito, which is really close to Harlingen, Texas. And it was run by Southwest Key, which is the largest kind of charity who runs the shelters in the area. They have shelters in California and Arizona, as well as Texas. And so I spent a lot of time at the time it was close to 100, teens mostly. I think the youngest at the time we were there was 11 years old, and the oldest are 17. Once they're 18, they graduate towards adult deportation, which is a much sadder situation. And those are usually for-profit companies who run those detention centers or shelters. So in these places, there are some rules set into place and protocols that are mandates the way that kids are treated. So they get health screenings. If they don't have any vaccination records, they get vaccinated once they're there. They also have an educational curriculum. They have activities that they do for the kids. And then they have a case manager, which helps them with their immigration proceedings and with placement with families. And then they have some counseling services as well to deal with. There's a lot of trauma that kids have been through either through the journey or from their lives that already existed there. Yeah. And so all of that kind of gets taken care of at the shelters. And the one thing I was surprised at, some of the shelters have raised some controversies in terms of the treatment of the kids, because the system got so overwhelmed going from 8,000 to tens and tens of thousands of kids, not excluding the San Benito shelter. They had to definitely change a lot of their protocols to deal with the number of kids that were coming across. But the one that I was in was better than I expected. So it's staffed by community members who are kind of trained to deal with this, other than the counselors who have to have, you know, counseling training, obviously, and certification. And they, the members there have been involved in this with these kids for many, many years, not just with the surge. And so they understand what the kids are experiencing. They interact with them every day. They know their stories. Some of the kids maybe get placed with local communities, so they understand the population very well and are advocates for the kids. And so they really do try and act in their best interest within the boundaries of the sort of regulation set by ORR. And so they decorate, for example, during the holidays. They try and decorate both for like holidays from those countries and U.S. holidays. They do a lot of activities with kids, and they try their best, but it's definitely not a great, I don't think, the best environment for kids long term.
Because the thing you have to remember is, you know, they might, you might think, oh, they have activities for the kids, but in reality, these are prisons.
Yeah,
these are prisons for children. And no matter, you know, no matter how much you dress it up, no matter how much the staff cares, these are detention centers. These are prisons for children whose crime was to be born in a land of poverty. And the only way they saw out was to follow the stream.
And you definitely feel that. So every, so the whole shelter is surrounded by a locked fence. And all the doors exiting out of the shelter are locked. You have to have badges to exit. And then within it, they're also further locked. So it's really hard to get out. They do have outdoor activities, which they can, but they're always with staff, obviously, per number of kids, a certain number of staff have to be with them. And they can't really go anywhere on their own, including bathrooms, or anywhere within the facility, really. Somebody's always watching over them. And then every 15 minutes, there's a count to make sure that the number of kids is equal. So they're all on walkie-talkies. And so say the kids are all in classroom activities at that point. Each classroom will count how many kids there are, and then they'll make sure that the count is even. And if it's not, they'll have to go through a whole other recount, and it kind of gets complicated. And so all of these protocols interfere with any sort of normal life that the kids might experience at all. And in addition to the fact that they are in a place where they don't know anybody, they're separated from their families, they still have the trauma that they've experienced from the trip in their mind. And a lot of expectations that they might have had coming to the U.S. are obviously not being met at all. So it's kind of another hardship. Like once they've already maybe traveled 3,000 miles, maybe have been abused or undergone trauma in or psychological or physical along the way, and then they get to the U.S., which they're hoping is an out, and they actually wind up being in a facility. So the average stay is supposed to be around 2 weeks. I think it's like it winds up being 29 days. But I do remember there were a handful of kids who were there for up to 3 months because they had difficulties. One kid in particular, he didn't really have any family in the States to be sheltered with, and the family that he had in his home country were abusive, and he couldn't go back to that. And so he was kind of in limbo dealing with him. And you definitely saw that behaviorally because he was seeing all these kids coming and going, and he's still there. And that can be really difficult. And as no matter how much of a bond you form with the staff who are there, in the end, they're very limited with their interactions because it's heavily regulated, their behavior towards them and what they can do and things like that. And they can't really show any particular special treatment towards anybody. So really, other than the counselors, you know, they don't have anybody to lean on in a significant way. And so that can be really, really difficult. And we definitely saw that whenever we're trying to do classroom activities with some of the behavior that he had and the way he interacted with other people or how he dealt with it, with kind of those issues. So it's not, it's definitely improved since the late 90s when the passage of the laws to make sure that kids aren't just being sent back to sometimes their death. And there have been further progressions in ensuring and maybe observing that treatment of kids is done better and more humanely, but it's not, it's most likely going to have long-term implications for these kids in their future in a negative way.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a minute.
on the Short Code Podcast.
The Art of Medicine Podcast explores topics in medicine through the lens of the arts and social sciences. Learn about an epileptic woman who created a virtual reality grand mal seizure, what doctors can learn from jazz musicians, and the experience of sexual assignment in a medicalized body. Download us on iTunes and visit us at www.theartofmedicinepodcast.com. We are a member of the Vocalis Network, the podcast network for medical students. Please listen to our partner podcasts at vocalisnetwork.wix.com/listen.
We're back with Melissa Palma and Hana Kadir talking about their away rotation at in the Rio Grande Valley of Texas. I want to turn to you guys. What was your work like there during your clerkship?
Mm-hmm. So this clerkship was very much about taking medical students and empowering them to be activists for health needs, both in this community and in their own home communities. So, as many of you know, there's a large proportion of patients in the United States whose primary language is Spanish. And so I myself do speak Spanish because I had foresight as an undergrad and said, I'm going to get a Spanish minor because I really need to learn how to speak Spanish if I want to be a doctor. But not so many other people are so fortunate. And so we did have daily Spanish classes every day with some amazing people, learning more about different health practices, improving our Spanish language vocabulary. We also had lectures every day from different community members who worked in various community organizations. So we had someone from Texas Legal Aid. We had someone from who's going to be the new medical director of the new medical school they're building in the lower Rio Grande Valley. We had lectures from Jennifer Harbury. She was amazing civil rights lawyer and activist during the Guatemala Civil War in the 90s.
Which is an unbelievable story, a ridiculously unbelievable, amazing story.
Yeah. And then the two of us, we had our own community engagement projects that we were involved in. So
did you come up with these projects? Were they assigned to you?
Yeah. So we were able to choose from a list of different community organizations that work with this community for children medical student rotation every year. And so each year there's two groups of medical students who come down, one in October, like we did, and one in February. And so each successive group of medical students can build off of the work that other students have done. So it's not just like we're going to be here for a month and then leave, but it's actually a continual, sustainable cycle that can have impacts in communities. So I myself did a project with a organization called ARISE, and it's actually an acronym. It stands for a Resource in Serving Equality. Working with the Women of ARISE, it's a organization that empowers women who live in colonias, or which are very poor communities in rural parts of South Texas along the border. And when they were first being built, the colonias didn't have paved streets, they didn't have running water, they didn't have trash collection. They were just communities of people who were too poor to live anywhere else. And because these areas had such low tax base, the city saw no reason to incorporate them or provide any sorts of services. And over time, that's changed, but it's still, the colonias are still in floodplains. They still have lots of problems with access to social services. And so ARISE is a community organization of women who actually live in these communities in the colonias, and they provide a lot of health education and English courses, and even Get Out the Vote campaigns to empower community members to take active roles in their own health. And so for my project, I worked with another medical student on the rotation, and the leaders of ARISE, Ramona, they asked us to somehow try to address this taboo topic of people who live in mixed documentation status families, people who live with the fear that at any moment their mother or their husband or their children could be taken away from them and deported at any point in time. Because down in the valley, the Border Patrol presence is it's essentially omnipresent. You can't go anywhere without seeing a Border Patrol car or a Border Patrol agent on a bicycle. And this militarization of border communities, the constant policing and the fear that it has within these communities causes a lot of chronic stress and anxiety and depression. And as future medical professionals, they wanted us to have our own education campaigns, talk with people to talk about symptoms and give them essentially like the vocabulary they could use to discuss such a taboo topic that no one in the community was really talking about before. And so we viewed ourselves kind of as catalysts to give space or make it okay for people to talk about it, using the, you know, we kind of call it the power of the physician advocate to be able to give maybe legitimacy to things that people were internalizing but not able to speak about themselves. And so so for a month we worked with, in conjunction with the Arise community members, people who are well known to the women who live in this community, and then us, the medical students, going out and in being able in Spanish to do some education sessions with groups. And also for some of the little kids, the elementary school kids, we used this book called Poncho Rabbit, The Migrant's Tale. And essentially it's a picture book that takes the migrant story of having to travel along the train or La Bestia through Mexico, through dangerous deserts, through Border Patrol, crossing the river into the United States from Central America. And so it's this very archetypal story that is portrayed through animals and through a storybook so that children can have an allegory to hold on to in a way that, you know, maybe they don't know why their parents are no longer there. Maybe they don't know why these things are happening to them, but to provide it in a way that that is safer so that people don't have to talk about, you know, if they were abused along the way. So people don't have to talk about personal stories, but to provide a framework to talk about the Poncho Rabbit story instead.
So what did you guys do when you weren't doing your clerkship? I mean, were there times when you could, you know, sort of explore and look around? And
yes, I think the most interesting thing was that there was a great deal of emotional exhaustion that occurred with the rotation. I want to say within the first 2 days, I was already in tears.
Yeah.
After we had a lot of sessions with Dr. Griffin and with all of us together discussing some of these issues and talking about their experience with the community. And that's something, it's really difficult to express what it's like or to try and explain unless you're there. And so I would come kind of at the end of the day, either even after class days or at the end of Southwest Key days or after even some of the readings that we had, and you just physically felt exhausted because of all of that. And so there was some reflection between all of us where we discuss all these things and try and talk about it further, which helped, or otherwise we didn't.
Yeah.
But then we also had a lot of get-togethers as a group that were more fun with food. We at one point we took some trips like downtown in McAllen to a salsa club, which was really fun. And so we had a couple of those, but not as much as I thought there would be, just because the amount of learning that occurred about all of these different issues. There's some other projects that were going on that we kind of don't have time to talk about. For example, a couple of the students were doing a project on strangulation and violence, domestic violence that was occurring in the area, and how undocumented women have no voice to try and get out of situations because of their undocumented status, along with a host of other things. So learning about that, and in addition to our own individual projects, and then trying to get a little bit more into the history, we mostly did a lot of discussion and group get-togethers about that.
Because it's a lot to unpackage, because you come in as medical students hoping that you can help in some way, and then learning about problems that are so much bigger than yourself, and, you know, feeling overwhelmed and all of these things. But, you know, at the end of the day, you are the one who gets to leave. You are the one who gets to go back to wherever place you came from and continue living your life, while everyone else that you worked so closely with for a whole month, they're still doing it. That's their life. And you want to try and help in whatever way possible. And I feel like one thing that we definitely learned as, you know, medical students who are very interested in social justice and in health policy and in social determinants of health, healthcare access, all of the above, is that, you know, finding the small ways in which we can do our part in what, you know, whether it be, you know, volunteering at the free medical clinic, or
voicing the issues that are going on. For example, saying that these unaccompanied minors aren't just coming here because they think that the laws are permissive for them to come here. They're coming because of actual violence that they're facing at home.
The alternative is to, you know, to that violence is to come here and be detained.
Yes.
Which surely many of them realize.
To some degree. It's kind of surprising, though, because there's some knowledge, kind of obviously, but not enough to deter, because people will make this trip over and over again. If they do get deported, they'll come again, because it's still nothing. Because
the alternative is, this alternative is better than, is much better than the one they face, even though it's fraught with uncertainty.
And so I remember when I was first learning about this issue in the news, it was a very negative, sort of the treatment that the kids were having was extremely negative in terms of actual communities blocking the buses from coming to into their towns,
right?
Harassing.
Depending on
profane,
who you depending on who you listen to, it's a discussion about, you know, how the immigrants are coming over and taking our work or our jobs or our, you know, or being violent or
spreading
criminals
to our kids, taking all the resources away from our own kids. And that was the message that I was hearing. And for the people who live there, who know what's going on, who interact with these kids, that's not true. And so for seeing them struggle to get the message out, one, even knowing that the amount of effect that us saying, okay, we were there and that's not true, even bringing that to Iowa was a huge difference. And it seems like that was something Dr. Griffin mentioned over and over again. They're considered down there, they're considered the experts in the issues, even though all they're doing is just the best they can. They feel like they're not, you know, they underestimate their own effects. But no one else is saying anything. And so they encourage us just even to share our own personal experiences with community members, just to try and get some of the misperceptions corrected.
As mentally draining as it was sometimes, were there ever moments where you just stopped and looked around and thought, this is why I came down here, this is what I wanted to do, this is why I love this?
I think definitely one of the moments that, I don't know about you, Hannah, was when...
I know what you're already going to say.
Yeah. So there's a shelter in Sacred Heart Church in downtown McAllen, Texas. And it is essentially 24 hours a day, there are people there who take in migrants before they get put on buses to whatever their next location is. And so these people come in, they come in after being, you know, kind of ejected from the detention center and say, okay, here's a bus ticket that your family paid for. Wait here, and then tomorrow you're going to get on a bus and go to New York or California or Michigan or wherever you're going to go. And they just leave them there with no money. They already strip them of everything they owned. They take away the mother's prenatal vitamins. They take away anything medications that you have on you, except for maybe the clothes you have on. And if you had some identification cards, they'll let you keep that. And that's all they have in the world. And
some of them are with infants, like, or pregnant mothers,
pregnant women
who've gone through this.
And so this church in downtown McAllen, Sacred Heart Church, runs this organization where they feed people. They give them a new set of clothes. If they're going somewhere cold, they'll try to give them something a little bit warmer. You know, they give them some soup to eat because they can't give them real food because they've been starved for maybe a couple weeks at a time. So if they give them heavy food, it will actually be worse for them. So they give them a bowl of warm soup and they give them kindness. And it's literally the first kind thing that are saying. When immigrants walk in, they stand up and they clap and they cheer and they say welcome, because it's the first time anyone has ever shown them kindness in this country.
And families will cry at that response, at that welcome. And so that was definitely... And it was fun even to pick out clothes for kids. I had like a little, she was like maybe 6 years old, and she absolutely loved her outfit that I picked out, which was probably the happiest I was the whole month that I was there, just picking out a flowery outfit for a little girl who was really excited to get a new outfit. And at those moments, you, even though it's not necessarily medical, but to be involved in sort of that kind of service was a clear, aha, this is what I got into this for moment. And it was, there were many, many days that occurred for all of us, for certain. And in, you know, there's one thing is like never underestimate, no matter what your contribution is, the power that it has, especially given that many other people are doing their own small part and hopefully we're progressing forward. And so I think that was like a major message. Like when you get into the nitty gritty details, these are incredibly complicated. There's no situations, there's no simple solutions, right? It's going to take a lot of effort. There's already been, you know, much done and much needs to be done. And it's nothing any individual person, let alone fourth year medical students with absolutely no usable skills or expertise can do to solve the problem overnight. But you can do what you're able to. And even just being present and witnessing what was going on was empowering.
So we've been speaking with Hannah Kadir and Melissa Palma about their experiences in a clerkship down south at the in the Rio Grande Valley. And thank you guys so much.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you like what you heard today on the Short Code Podcast, leave us a review and some stars on iTunes or Stitcher. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to tell us your moment of truth if something strange or wonderful happened to you. If you're annoyed or pleased about something, or if you want to suggest a story idea to us, leave us a message at theshortcoat.com. Do follow us and talk to us on Twitter so that we can all stay up to date on what's happening at the margins of medicine. The show is made possible by this strange world we live in and a generous donation by the Carver College of Medicine Student Government and the Writing and Humanities Program. Our executive producer is Jason Lewis. Our intern is Corey Christensen. Our opening music is by Dude Skywalker. And our closing music is by C2C. Talk to you in 1 week.